Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Mount Carmel West has fired a physician after an investigation showed that he had ordered excessive doses of pain medication for 27 patients from 2015 to 2018. Six pharmacists and 14 nurses also have been placed on administrative leave as the hospital continues its investigation. Coming up, we'll talk about the role that the physician-patient relationship may play and the standards of oversight and protocol when it comes to end-of-life care. WOSU reporter Paige Flager has been covering the story. She joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
How did this first come to light?
So on Monday of last week, there was a lawsuit that was filed, and Mount Carmel basically says that they were planning to kind of put out a release that this had happened on Wednesday, but this lawsuit preceded them. So on Monday, there was a lawsuit brought against Mount Carmel, Dr. Husel, and a pharmacist and a nurse. And then right after that, immediately following that, Mount Carmel kind of rushed to put out this statement about 27, at least 27 patients. Yeah, receiving excessive doses of the pain medication fentanyl.
Has anything changed as far as what Mount Carmel is saying about this case or these cases since then?
As far as what?
The numbers or any changes?
No, I think Mount Carmel is kind of sticking to the timeline that they put out. They say that they were first alerted in October. Something happened in November. They won't say what exactly that is. That kind of made them start to take action a little bit more seriously. And then in December, they fired Husel and put 20 nurses and pharmacists on administrative leave. And then after Christmas, end of December, they started reaching out to families, these 27 families, and saying, hey, we've already contacted you to say that maybe something was suspicious about the death of your loved one. Now we're contacting you to say that we took action. This doctor is no longer at the hospital. And basically that there's 27 other people who were affected in this same way.
How much information did the survivors receive about the cases of their family members?
That's basically it. So basically, from the hospital, at least, the hospital said, you know, we're looking into this. We suspect that maybe something went wrong. And at the end of December, they said, your loved one was given an excessive dose of fentanyl that's potentially fatal, and that doctor is no longer with us.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the issue of Mount Carmel West and the lawsuits that have been filed what the Mount Carmel West, how it has responded since the revelations that at least 27 people were the victims potential of excessive doses of painkillers. They were apparently on their deathbeds. They were all but one, I think, were at Mount Carmel West. One was at St. Anne's in Westerville. And all of them were being cared for by the same physician, Dr. William Husel. If you have a question or comment this hour, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the physician-patient relationships and how that might have played a role in these 27 plus, perhaps plus cases. We'll also be hearing from the Ohio Hospital Association to talk about standards of care and protocols when it comes to prescribing painkillers in this day and age. And we're also going to hear from one of the people who is suing Mount Carmel West over the death of his wife. 614-292-8513. Who else is investigating?
So right now, a whole slew of people are looking into this. The hospital is still looking into it on their own internally. And then the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office is looking into it. You've also got the police.
Columbus Police.
Yeah, Columbus Police that are looking into it. And then WOSU broke on, I think it was Friday, that the Ohio Health Department is looking into this, into Mount Carmel, on behalf of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid.
And what's that connection there?
Basically, the Ohio Department of Health functions kind of as the local level of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and they'll do things like surveys of hospitals just to make sure that hospitals are abiding by all the guidelines that they need to. This sort of investigation that is stems from kind of a complaint, a problem, is relatively rare. So in the last, I think it's in the last year, there were only three similar investigations.
In the country?
No, here in Ohio.
Okay.
So it's not super common that the Ohio Department of Health will like launch an investigation like this one.
And how do we expect the case to develop from here? What's the next step?
Well, so...
Or I should say cases.
Yeah, yeah. So the lawyers involved who are representing the people of those 20, the family members of those 27 people, they say that they're being reached out to by more families. So you'll probably see up to 27 lawsuits of those 27 people that were identified and reached out to by Mount Carmel. Whether or not we'll see more than that is unknown at this point.
What do we know about William Husel, the physician?
So he was a resident at the Cleveland Clinic and then came to Mount Carmel West. He works in the intensive care unit. So you'll see in all
That's
of these
That's different
cases,
than being in an emergency room doctor, right?
Yeah. So if you got brought into the emergency room and then you got admitted to the hospital, you could go to the intensive care unit.
Okay.
And so you'll see in a lot of these cases that people showed up to the hospital, to the emergency room with shortness of breath or what have you. And then they end up going to the intensive care unit. And that's where they fell under the care of Dr. William Husel.
He's 44. He lives up in Powell. What else do we know about him? Anything?
We don't know much. So he's not talking. His
Does
lawyer.
He has a doctor. I mean, a
lawyer.
A lawyer.
Yeah. His lawyer is not talking either. So we haven't really heard anything from him as of yet, which makes it really difficult to talk about things like motive, to say whether or not he was doing this on purpose, if it was a slew of accidents, which is, I think, at this point, kind of hard to believe based on the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we can't really hypothesize to why exactly this happened.
And you said based on the pattern. What do we know about the pattern?
We know that basically the gist of it is that at some point in these patients' care, Dr. William Husel said that they were like actively dying, that there was nothing that he could do at that point. And so you get into these conversations about comfort care. And fentanyl is a medication that is given to patients as part of comfort care.
We know it as something that's killing people in overdoses who are addicted to opioids.
Right. But,
it's actually used
in hospitals.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And so it's given as part of comfort care. The amount that was given by Husel to these patients is kind of being acknowledged by the hospital as excessive.
We don't know a motive. We don't know if this was physician-assisted suicide, but do we know whether or not any of the families, what all the different families were thinking at this point when they were said there's nothing we can do?
Yeah. So all of the families so far from the three lawsuits, so those are kind of the only people that we're hearing from, all of the families thus far have said that they didn't ask for this. They didn't.
They just said, keep my
yeah,
family
basically,
member comfortable.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, you can imagine being in the hospital and your doctor comes to you and says, you know, your family member, there's nothing more we can do. What do you want? And you say, yeah, make them comfortable for the remaining time. Probably take them off life support, which is what the hospital is referring to when they say ending life-saving measures.
Yeah.
And yeah, then it's very normal that those people would receive medication. But the amount of medication is
the
kind
question.
Of what's being called into
and
question.
And it's also called into question is whether or not all of these people were indeed at the end of life, that they couldn't be helped anymore.
Right. Yeah. So I think that kind of, you saw in the first two lawsuits, they were in the cases of, these were older women. I think one was 64, one was 79. And the third lawsuit that came out last week is kind of the one that is maybe making people raise eyebrows a little bit more. It was a 44-year-old and he had had some prior health problems. The lawyer admitted that. But he went in and fell under the care of William Husel in the intensive care unit. His wife says that she called the ambulance because he had a shortness of breath. And when he got to the hospital, at some point, it was identified that he had multiple organ system failure, which is something that is definitely life-threatening, but is not necessarily terminal. And so the question here is, did the doctor kind of make the decision that it was terminal without necessarily making sure that that was true or doing everything he could? Or was it that it was too far gone and there was nothing that he could actually do? So, and then that's the sort of thing where we don't really have all the details because we don't have those medical records, but we also don't have Husel's testimony.
Lewis in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lewis.
Yes, I am a critical care nurse, and we deal with end-of-life issues on a nearly daily basis. Mm-hmm. And the medications we administer at that point in a patient's life are for comfort care, to keep the patient comfortable. This dosing of fentanyl went far above the line into active euthanasia, and it was also a serious process failure. Pharmacy did not question the physician's order, nursing did not question the physician's order, and it was a significant process failure from the outset, which led to this tragedy.
You know, Lewis, we're going to be talking about this in more detail in the program, but I'm interested with your perspective. What is the protocol? What, as a critical care nurse, what are you taught? How are you taught to respond to a dosing issue?
We write up an incident report, and we call pharmacy, we question it, we call the physician, we question the order, and quite honestly, if a nurse feels that this is an inappropriate dosing or an inappropriate medication, we don't give it.
You don't give it. You have the right to not give that. Paige Flager?
I was just going to say, thank you for your question, that in an institution like a hospital, which is huge, absolutely huge, it's very possible that there were nurses or pharmacists raising questions about Husel's dosing and raising those questions with their managers. Now, whether or not that reached the highest echelon in Mount Carmel is unknown. So it's very possible, you can imagine, like any workplace, mm-hmm. you report something to your manager and maybe there's a talking to, maybe there's some sort of disciplinary action on your level, and then that maybe doesn't ever reach the highest part of the hospital, the executives.
But the question is, does it reach the place that it has to, and do we just don't know yet whether nurses and pharmacists felt comfortable stopping this?
Yeah.
We just don't know yet.
The hospital is being obviously quite tight-lipped about this, as well as a lot of employees inside the hospital are afraid to speak up about it. And so right now we can't say definitely whether or not people at a lower level raise concerns about Husel.
We are going to continue our conversation about what's going on at Mount Carmel West in the case of physician William Husel. He has been fired after the hospital discovered at least 27 patients were given excessive doses of a painkiller, apparently, in an end-of-life scenario. But physician-assisted suicide, that kind of thing is not legal in Ohio. It doesn't matter. It would never be legal, even if the patient agreed to it. We've been listening to Paige Flager. She's a WS reporter who has been covering the story. Paige, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we are going to hear from someone who teaches marketing and co-authored a study for the Mayo Clinic on the physician-patient relationship and how it can play into scenarios like this. And we'll also hear from the Vice President of Quality Programs at the Ohio Hospital Association. So if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Mount Carmel West Hospital has identified 27 patients, or at least 27 patients, believed to have been prescribed and given excessive doses of pain medication between 2015 and 2018. A physician has been fired, and 20 others, including pharmacists and nurses, have been placed on administrative leave pending an investigation by Mount Carmel, the Ohio Department of Health, the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office, and the Columbus Division of Police. The revelation last month has resulted in lawsuits and questions about how something like this could happen. Leonard Berry teaches marketing at Texas A&M. He also co-authored a study for the Mayo Clinic on the physician-patient relationship. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Leonard Berry.
Oh, thank you. Good morning, Ann.
And James Gugliano is Vice President of Quality Programs at the Ohio Hospital Association. He joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
James, what do hospitals do when it comes to the patient-physician relationship? Is there a protocol?
There is, and we refer to it as person and family engagement. And that takes into account two things: very proactive communication between the patient and any healthcare provider, in this case physician, but nursing, physical therapy, pharmacy, what have you, as well as very, very partnered decision-making. And that partner decision-making has to take into account an individual's needs, their beliefs, their values, their preferences. And so a great example of that would be change of shift communication, handoff from one shift to another, or discharge planning, making sure that the patient understands the plan of care, agrees to the plan of care.
And when you've decided as a physician that nothing more can be done, I guess I'll put that in quotation marks, is there protocol for that?
So I'm not here to talk about plan of care or standards of care, and I'm not a physician, but I will tell you that open communication between the patient, the family, and the provider, in this situation, the physician, for the question you're asking at end of life, is definitely an open conversation.
That physicians train to have.
There are various levels of end of life discussions that that involve training. For nursing, for example, there is an entire course on end-of-life nursing care and nursing communication.
Uh-huh. But for physicians?
I'm not familiar with the standards of care for physicians' graduate medical education on what they have in their curriculum.
Yeah. Okay. Leonard Berry, you have studied something called the hostage bargaining syndrome, which seems incongruent. People are there for healthcare, but you make a very solid case about what the similarities are, what the parallels are between when you're a patient or a loved one of a patient and dealing with medical people.
Yes, Ann. We, colleagues and I, published a paper in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, one of the leading medical journals, on the topic of patients as hostages. This doesn't happen all the time, but it happens too often, where patients basically behave, especially patients who are seriously ill and their family members, basically behave as though they were hostages, much like if you're a hostage to a kidnapping. And we studied the literature and sociology on kidnapped hostage behavior. And I've been studying healthcare, physician-patient relationships for many years, and it seemed quite similar to me to the way patients often behave in the presence of a physician, where they defer authority, where they don't challenge treatment plans, where they have concerns, but they don't express them because they don't want to offend the doctor, and they don't want to be labeled as a bad patient or a difficult patient. And so they keep quiet even when they have concerns. And so that's where the idea of patient as hostage came in our paper.
How do health systems, from what you understand, James Gliano, how do they decipher what patients are thinking or feeling when it comes to these things? Because I've been, and most of us have been by now, been in some kind of situation where you're talking to a doctor and they use a lot of their lexicon's very different, put it that way, and they're very comfortable talking about it. But how much are they trained, and can they even be trained to understand what the patient's going through or their loved ones?
Yes. So it's on multiple levels. So first of all, I think Dr. Barry and I might agree on the fact that this type of communication needs to be a culture of openness, where it's acceptable, where it's encouraged. And in order for that culture of openness to happen, we know that it's heavily driven by leadership, but not just leadership in hospitals and in healthcare, but leadership in insurance providers and leadership in pharmaceutical providers, medical supply providers, so that at any point, any touch point in the continuum of care, whether I'm in an outpatient facility, an inpatient facility, extended care, I have the ability to ask questions and to dialogue. So I would say that that's first. Second of all, one of the things that we at the Ohio Hospital Association are doing throughout the state are working with our member hospitals to build programs of person and family engagement. And one major part of that is building what we call patient family advisory councils. And that is placing a patient on the highest level of board governance, which is the board, to advise the board on patient-related issues from a patient's perspective. So hearing the voice of the patient and the family, not just from, you know, the healthcare providers, but from an actual patient and family. And this is happening in hospitals.
And what is the impact? What has it been? I mean,
so a couple of things to let you know about this is that a patient family advisory council is not a support group. It's not a complaint process. Hospitals do have complaint processes in place. Everyone has a different
type of
process.
Type of thing, yeah.
Yes. These are working groups with governing bylaws that bring issues to the table. They may be issues that are very proactive to say we need to work on, for example, better signage or better discharge planning or better ways to communicate whatever the issue may be that's identified by the Patient Family Advisory Council. So needs are assessed, needs are then addressed in that format.
Leonard Berry, as far as there's the dynamic and the human interaction and the dynamic of that, there's also the place, being in a hospital. Do you know, or have you looked into how that affects the comfort level of patients and their families?
Oh, it affects it greatly. The being in a hospital is the most stressful building in which you can be, of all kinds of buildings. And in fact, along with colleagues, architects and designers, I've studied how we can improve the design of hospitals to make them less intimidating and less stressful for the occupants, not just the patients, but the families, because families come to the hospital with patients too. And of course, the staff who work in the hospital. There's a lot we can do with evidence-based design to make hospitals less intimidating than they are. But right now, people who enter the front door of a hospital almost universally are under unusual amounts of stress. And the question becomes, how do we make the hospital environment less stressful, both the facility and also the service provided inside the hospital?
Because, right, James Gugliano, there's a lot of evidence to show that the stress actually affects somebody's response to medical care.
Sure, stressors do that, absolutely.
And is that an issue, or is that something that hospitals talk about? How do we change that? I mean, I know that you can walk into almost any hospital in Central Ohio, at least, and they're quite beautiful, and there's usually nice music, and there's, you know, everything's very nice. But the closer you get to that emergency room or the ICU, that changes.
Right. And I think beyond the aesthetics that you're talking about, what hospitals are doing proactively is making sure that those conversations are happening right at the point of entry. Mm-hmm. And so it's assessing needs, not only beyond the physical needs, but also values, also belief systems, spiritual care needs, physical needs, needs of the family as well, looking at what an individual's routine of care normally would be. I might be a patient with a chronic condition and have a routine of care at home. And when I come into an environment that's not my own home, that may change. And so being in touch with that patient early on to find out their preferences early on is so very important. And that's part of person and family engagement.
You know, so Leonard Berry, we're talking about that hostage bargaining syndrome that takes hold in medical relationships. Is it heightened necessarily in an emergency situation?
It's heightened when patients are more at risk, when patients are seriously ill. We found in our research that hostage bargaining syndrome can happen in any physician-patient encounter, but it's more likely when the patient has more at stake, when the patient is more afraid, when the patient's life might be on the line. And so serious illness is the most fertile grounds for hostage bargaining syndrome to arise. And while I have the air, Anne, mm-hmm. I'd like to go back for a minute, if you don't mind, to James' earlier point about patient advisory councils.
Yeah,
I'm a strong advocate of that. I agree with James. I've written about that sort of thing. What I like about it is it formally invites the patient into the conversation. It welcomes the patient. It makes the patient feel safe to speak up, which is the opposite of hostage bargaining syndrome. But we need to go beyond, as you've implied in your questions, Anne, we need to go beyond the formal patient advisory council and train and educate physicians to be comfortable one-on-one with their patients in inviting patients into the conversation, in making them feel safe to disagree, to ask questions, to express their concerns. And there are ways to do that that I can share.
Yeah, how? James mentioned end-of-life studies for nurses in their curriculum, but it's unclear that physicians get the same kind of training. What are you thinking about, Leonard Berry?
Yes, well, those discussions need to happen with the patient and with family members that the patient is comfortable in having along as early as possible in the course of disease, rather than when it's an emergency, it's a crisis, or when the patient can't speak for herself or himself because he or she is so sick. And so the earlier the so-called conversation can have with loved ones as to what kind of care, what level of care do you want when you're really sick and curative treatment is not possible or not likely, having that conversation and having family members on the same page with the physician involved, physician informed, and having that conversation and the agreement between the patient and the family and the physician recorded in the electronic health record for any physician to see is the ideal situation.
What about the process of asking for a second opinion? You're in an emergency room, you're in ICU, someone says, I'm sorry, you know, there's nothing more we can do. Is this a reasonable time for a patient or a patient advocate of whatever stripe to say, I want a second opinion?
I'm a strong advocate of second opinions when the patient is in doubt. The patient has a lot at risk and a lot at stake. And a competent physician, a competent and competent physician, should not be alarmed or concerned about patients seeking a second opinion. There's a great deal of variability in the clinical experience and clinical quality of physicians, just like in any other profession.
Mm-hmm.
And so getting a second opinion is often a very good idea.
Is that encouraged? How does that work in a hospital setting? Can you talk about that, James Gugliano?
Yes, it is encouraged. And again, it gets back to having that open culture and making sure that the patient is in a spot to be able to ask questions. Sometimes patients and families don't know what to ask,
right,
or how to articulate it. And I think the two key things here is, number one, consistency of making sure that there's that time of reflection to say, do you have any questions? Is there anything that you're struggling with in your knowledge, of what I've told you? Number one, having that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two, being able to respond to those in a way that does not intimidate or does not make anyone feel like that's a bad thing. Because communication in this situation needs to be proactive. And as we mentioned earlier, it needs to be a partner decision-making, not unilateral.
And so a patient advocate, like I'll say a husband or a spouse, says, I'd really like to get a second opinion. What do I do? And that's up to the physician at that point to...
It depends to whom they make that request,
right,
on the care team, of course. However, yes, then that is escalated, to the point of making sure that that gets addressed. So is the, here are the options for your second opinion. Do we have those services here? Do we not have those services here? What does that include? And so full information. And person and family engagement, Anne, it goes beyond simply informed consent.
Yeah.
It's that kind of dialogue that you're talking about. Yes.
Okay. And just one more question, and if you can't answer it, I completely understood, but when a physician decides nothing more can be done, I'll put that in quotation marks, but just that point, is there an obligation? Is there any protocol that we know of that says the physician ought to seek a second opinion themselves?
I would not be able to answer that question on
all
behalf,
right,
of a physician. I am not a physician, and I need to make that very clear.
Yeah, Leonard Berry?
Yes, I'm not a physician either, but I've studied with physicians for almost 20 years now and feel comfortable addressing that question.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a comment, if you'd like, and if you have time, Anne, about the Mount Carmel health system issue, but we can do
sure.
that
if
you'd like. But the issue of there's nothing more can be done is something that a physician should never say. Period. It's a never phrase in my world.
Okay.
They should never phrase, because even though the physician can no longer provide curative treatment, the patient is going to die from the disease. There is always a lot more that the physician and the healthcare team can do to help the patient, to help the family, to control the pain, to help the patient get into a better place emotionally, to stand by the patient's side. And so a physician, in my view, should never say to a family, there's nothing more that can be done. So I wanted to make that point.
Okay.
It's a very important point. All I know about the Mount Carmel Health System is what I have read. I've read quite a bit. It's a heartbreaking story, and it's not a unique story in Ohio. This sort of thing has happened before,
mm-hmm,
and will happen again around the world, around the country, in different health systems. But the reason I wanted to bring it up here is we've been talking about hostage bargaining syndrome, and one of the striking points of the story, this tragic story at Mount Carmel, is the large number of nurses and pharmacists and other doctors who didn't step in before 27 patients or more were affected. And so my hypothesis was hostage bargaining syndrome at play there, where the staff basically behaving like a hostage to the physician, Dr. Huzel, if that's his pronunciation, and not speaking up, even though they had grave concerns. I don't know. I wasn't there.
But that's the same dynamic takes hold, is what you're saying. It's not just a patient physician, but it's also a superiority inferiority dynamic.
Yes, that is a hypothesis in this case. It's striking to me that many people had to know what was going on, and no one stopped it.
Leonard Berry, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Leonard Berry is a professor of marketing at Texas A&M. He's co-author of a study that was done on behalf of the Mayo Clinic on physician-patient relationships. And James Gugliano, vice president of quality programs at the Ohio Hospital Association. Thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, we're going to hear from the spouse of one of the 27 named by Mount Carmel West as being affected by this physician in these cases. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Mount Carmel West Hospital has identified at least 27 patients believed to have been prescribed and given excessive doses of pain medication between 2015 and 2018. A physician has been fired. 20 others, including pharmacists and nurses, have been placed on administrative leave pending several investigations. The Ohio Department of Health, the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office, and the Columbus Division of Police all are investigating. The revelation last month has resulted in lawsuits and questions about how something like this could happen. Bonnie Austin died in September at Mount Carmel West, where she was taken when she was having difficulty breathing. She was among those 27 identified by Mount Carmel West. Her husband, David Austin, has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against Mount Carmel, the prescribing physician, William Husel, a pharmacist, and a nurse. And he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Also with us, attorney David Schroyer. He's representing David Austin. He joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Listeners, Mount Carmel administrators declined our invitation to appear on the program. Wanted to let you know about that. First off, Mr. Austin, tell us what happened. That I guess it was the night you took your wife to the hospital or the day you took her to the hospital?
Yeah, she, excuse me, she was sitting there watching TV, and she started having trouble breathing, and she asked me to call the squad. We called the squad. They took her there, and they took her out to the squad, and I guess she was went into respiratory rest, and they started doing CPR on her, and they took her to the took her to the ER, they finally got her together, and they called me into the emergency room, and they said they finally got her heart started with the machine, said with her and the machine, the heart was working with the machine. Mm-hmm. And she seemed everything to be fine, that she was going to be okay. I thought she was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And the doctor, and they sent her up to ICU. And I thought, everything's going to be fine. And then that's when the doctor told me she was going to, she was brain dead. The machines, she wasn't going to live because it was she wasn't going to live without heart. Her heart wouldn't work without the heart machine and the lung machine and stuff like that.
And they were going to, and you said,
They said, I said, my wife had already planned it. if we couldn't live without the machine to pull the plug.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from David Austin. He is suing Mark Comer West over the death of his wife, Bonnie, back in September 30th. If you have a question or comment, also with us is David Schroyer. He's the attorney representing David Austin in the lawsuit. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've been talking about the patient physician relationship, and in your case, the patient advocate and the physician relationship. Did they give you a chance to ask questions?
Well, my mind wasn't working too good.
Yeah.
Up there, all he did was saying that she had no chance, no hope at all. He didn't give me nothing. He just said she had no hope at all.
And when Mount Carmel called you and told you about the circumstances that they suspect in her death, what was your first reaction? What did you think?
Well, at first I said, do what? Are you kidding? Or is this a joke? This can't be true. What are you talking about?
And they just told you and that was that.
Basically, that was it, you know. It couldn't be. And then
go ahead.
And then they came up on the second phone call saying that there was 27 people that they had this pain medicine that before they died, given to them. And I said, no, this can't be true. You can't do this. This can't be. You're joking, right?
It seems impossible. David Schroyer, that's what everyone keeps saying, is how could this happen and how could so many people be involved?
Well, that's a good question. She was given 600 micrograms. The normal dosage for fentanyl should be between 50 at a maximum of 100. So this was
way off the chart.
And so you have redundancy built in hospital systems. First, you have the prescribing doctor. This was an intentional lethal administration of a lethal drug. That's murder.
There's no question.
No. Our experts have said that's way over any sort of dosage that, and we do know that that will, in fact, cause death. Then you have the pharmacist who filled the order, and then you have the nurse. Now, the nurse has to be the advocate for the patient. The nurse has to question orders. A nurse cannot just accept an order blindly. They must exercise their independent judgment. And if they object to it, they should say they object. And if the doctor still insists, if they have concerns, they go to their nurse manager and they work their way up the chain of command.
But nothing can be done in the meantime.
Well, the nurse is the one that pushes the medication.
That's the stopgap.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about it, the way it's done is there's a Pyxis machine. The order is placed for the 600 micrograms. The nurse goes over, puts her fingerprint on, the drawer pops out. The fentanyl is in 50 microgram containers. She would have, in this case, had to have pulled out 12 of these vials, drawn out of each one, all 12, to fill the needle before administering it. Something should have gone off and said, this is unusual. I haven't done this before. I'm going to question this order. So you have redundancy built in the system, but if people ignore the red flags or people don't speak up, then a rogue doctor can get away with this type of lethal injections that apparently have been going on for 4 years.
The nurse is the last advocate for the patient, but the pharmacists have due diligence, do they not?
Well, they do. And in this case, the pharmacist also has the same obligation to question it and not fill it. Our experts are telling us that these kind of dosages are lethal. There's just no question about that. I think we're going to find out through depositions exactly what occurred and why these people acted the way they did based upon these doctor's orders. Perhaps he was persuasive. Perhaps he said to them, look, I know what I'm doing. We don't know that yet. But there's a duty to question orders and stand up for what you know from your base, you know, your training.
Yeah. When I'm Mr. Austin, tell us something about your wife. I mean, she by this time when she started that day, had she had other ailments? Had she been?
Well, she had a heart attack about a year before that, mm-hmm. down in Tennessee when she was visiting her sister. She's had kidney problems, stuff like this. But she's had other little ailments, but at that time, I didn't think she was going to die.
Right.
I thought she was going to, from what that doctor said at the ER, I thought she was going to come home.
How old was she?
She was 64. She had just.
Very young.
She was 64. She had had her birthday about 5 days before then.
Family party?
Our little pet party with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have children?
We got three grandkids. She loved her grandkids. She always did that.
You know, let's see. I'm going to put Charlotte on the air. Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. My heartfelt sympathies to all the family. I worked as a lab tech at the University of Chicago Hospital doing cross matches for kidneys, livers, and pancreas a couple of decades ago.
Uh-huh.
I do not understand how no one saw even one dose get by the system, never mind 27 doses. I just don't grasp it. And I know, please don't tell me about hostage syndrome. Yes, I was the low person on the totem pole, a Mustang on the job training lab tech when that was still possible. I saw something that didn't look right in the lab. I tried to speak up. I was told I didn't know what I was talking about. And when I gave my notice the last day, when the chain of command was out of my way, I went over to a parallel thing to the administrator and said, by the way, this is why I'm leaving. And in the end, I heard through the grapevine that the former supervisor of mine was given a choice between resigning effective immediately or facing federal prosecution.
Okay. So Charlotte's saying there's no excuse.
Well, that's what we contend. There's no justifiable reason for giving a lethal dose of any medication in a hospital or in hospice, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the nurses are the eyes and ears for the administration. They're the boots on the ground. They're the last, you know, point of stopping errors from occurring. And they have to stand up and say no, simply. And they have the right to refuse a doctor's order. I took a deposition 2 months ago where the nurse said, I always follow what the doctor tells me to do. The doctor is always right. That's totally inappropriate. That's not what nurses are supposed to be trained. They're supposed to question, verify.
And Mr. Austin, did anybody else talk to you about what was happening besides the doctor at the hospital that night?
Nobody talked to me except that he said that she was. Are you talking about down at the ER?
He said
everything is fine, and the guy up at the
ICU?
Doctor up at the ICU said she was brain dead, and said the machine was the only thing keeping her alive.
Yeah, David Troyer.
Brain death is a
technical term, isn't it?
It is, and the neurologists have standards that they follow to determine brain death.
Yeah.
Brain death is irreversible coma, brainstem non-functioning, and failing a breathing test. And often there's all sorts of tests and protocols that are followed. You can't do that in 2 hours. So unfortunately, in this case, Mr. Austin believed the doctor. He trusted the doctor that she was brain dead. That, we believe, will show that that had not been yet determined at this point in time. Yet that was the protocol or the basis upon which he consented to withdrawing life support.
There's also, and correct me if I'm wrong, but a question about when the fatal dose was administered. Was it before or after Mr. Austin gave permission?
Well, we don't know.
We don't know.
We know that the recordation of the consent was 5 minutes after the dose had been given, but that computer notes when that's typed into the computer. So
right.
It could have been typed earlier. We just don't know that. That's part of the discovery that will be going on in the case.
And do we know anything about motive at this point? I mean, is there any information that's shedding any light on why?
Well, we don't. And interestingly enough, we'll be taking the deposition of the doctor. He will probably assert his Fifth Amendment privilege. that cannot be used in a criminal case, but in a civil case, a jury can be informed that the doctor's asserted Fifth Amendment privilege refuses to testify, and that can be an inference of guilt.
And that's why often we don't know why things happen, because it's an inference of guilt.
Yeah, well, the only person who can answer that question is him. And the question is, will he answer the question? He has a Fifth Amendment privilege,
right,
which I'm sure he'll be asserting.
David Schroyer, attorney representing David Austin in a lawsuit against Mount Carmel West. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David Austin, I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing the story with us today. I appreciate it.
Okay.
David Austin, he is suing Mount Carmel West over the death of his wife, Bonnie, on September 30th. She was 64 years old. He was told she was brain dead. Gave them permission to take her off life support, and now we know that she's among 27 people identified as people who were given fatal doses of fentanyl. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.